darle la bienvenida a esta sesión sobre la epidemia del VIH y SIDA en los Estados Unidos y todos sus territorios. Los saludo en español, el idioma primario para más de 47 millones de los habitantes de mi país. Y también les recuerdo que un estimado 250 mil a 300 mil latinos viven con el VIH-SIDA en los Estados Unidos. Good afternoon. My name is David Ernesto Munar, and I'm HIV positive, Colombian American, and a gay male. I proudly serve as board chair of the National Association of People with AIDS and work at the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. This afternoon's session strikes an emotional chord in me. How much data must we amass before we invigorate efforts against HIV/AIDS? As we reflect on the data and questions raised by the presentations today, please keep forward in your mind the people and the lives behind every statistic and every graph. I intentionally open today's session in the language of our host country, and it also is the primary language for 47 million people in the United States, including as many as many of the 250 to 300,000 Americans living with HIV/AIDS. For this afternoon's session, we'll invite our five presenters, distinguished presenters, to speak, one right after the other, and then open the floor for your questions. It is my distinct honor to share the podium with such a distinct panel of experts and committed public servants. Co-moderating today's session with me is the Honorable Barbara Lee, who co-authored the Lantos-Hyde U.S. Global Leadership Against HIV/AIDS Bill, signed into law last week, and was instrumental in repealing the stigmatizing HIV immigration and entry ban from federal law. Representative Lee chairs the Congressional Black Caucus Task Force on HIV/AIDS and is leading efforts in Congress to improve HIV prevention services. Please give a warm welcome to U.S. Representative Barbara Lee.
Good afternoon, and let me just thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for your work each and every day. We all know that, yes, we will stamp HIV and AIDS from the face of the earth. Thank you again so much. Let me thank you, David, from the AIDS Foundation of Chicago, for all of your work and for serving as co-chair for this really important session, and also to all of our panelists today. Let me just acknowledge and thank the IAS and Craig McClure and Dr. Helene Gale, because when I talk to them about having a focus in a session looking at what is taking place in our own country, they got it so quickly. And they said, let's see what we can do. And here we are today. So I just have to say to the IAS and to Craig McClure and Dr. Gale, thank you very much for bringing this focus to this wonderful International AIDS Conference. Of course, with the release of the new HIV incidence numbers from the CDC, this satellite session could not be more timely. Yes, that's right. Will you all kind of check out what they're saying to you today? And let's give them a round of applause. Now, let me say, I have been a delegate at each of the last five international AIDS conferences, including, of course, this one, and I've long spoken about the need to integrate the U.S. HIV/AIDS epidemic into discussions about the global pandemic. At the last conference in Toronto, we saw the first major discussion of HIV and AIDS among the African-American community. We were pleased, and we were participating with great leaders such as Julian Bond, of the NAACP, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, Congresswoman Donna Christensen, and many other prominent African Americans. I believe that this time around in Mexico City, we have gone one step further. The thought-provoking and groundbreaking report from the Black AIDS Institute, Left Behind, has for the first time equated the epidemic in Black America in terms that the international community can understand very clearly. It has really shown some sunshine into what is going on in the United States of America. If Black America were a separate nation, it would rank 16th in the world in the number of people living with HIV. The release of the new incidence numbers by the CDC are frankly confirmation of what many of us have said all along. Of course, we know just as with the census in America, communities of color are always undercounted. We knew that there was a glaring undercount as it relates to HIV and AIDS in the African American community. So I'm glad that CDC has finally acknowledged what we knew all along. Thank you, Dr. Fenton, very much. Dr. Fenton will, of course, discuss the numbers themselves. And let me just say that, of course, we all have been disturbed to read that the estimate of the new annual infections had risen by over 40%. However, it's no surprise that 45% of infections were among African Americans and 53% were among men who have sex with men. Clearly, we have not done enough to address the AIDS epidemic within the African American community, within the Latino community, among men who have sex with men, with African-American women, but those who I'm most concerned about are young Black gay men who carry the burdens of both of these communities. The U.S. failed to fight AIDS. Thank you very much. We do need to reinvigorate and revitalize our response to our own epidemic. I hope that the CDC numbers and the Black AIDS Institute report will help spur the political will. And let me tell you, it takes a lot of political will. I serve on the Foreign Affairs Committee, and I'm also on the Appropriations Committee. I'm on the committees that fund our foreign development assistance initiatives and the committee, the subcommittee that funds our domestic HIV/AIDS initiatives, Ryan White, our minority AIDS initiatives. And I can just tell you, the political will is not quite there yet, with the exception of members of the Congressional Black Caucus and the Hispanic Caucus and the Progressive Caucus. So we have to understand this is a political struggle also, and begin to mount a major political battle in America to combat HIV and AIDS with the seriousness and with the urgency that it deserves. That's what we've got to do, and our brothers and sisters are beginning that right now today. Let me give you an example. In my hometown of Oakland, California, and I'm really proud of Oakland, Get Screened Oakland, Marsha Martin, Mayor Ron Dellums, we've taken the lead in making sure that our community organizations are funded, that testing is a priority, that all of the initiatives that we all know so well work, we're beginning to do in Oakland. We had to declare a state of emergency in Alameda County in 1999 as it relates to the African American community. We tried then to declare a state of emergency in Washington, D.C. at the national level, but we couldn't quite get there. So I think it's about time that we do that and that we call for a national AIDS strategy and a national AIDS plan. That's what we need to do. And so I know that when I return to the United States tomorrow, I will be talking with my colleagues in Congress like I do after each International AIDS Conference, Speaker Pelosi, members of the Congressional Black Caucus, Progressive Caucus, Hispanic Caucus. I'm going to talk to all of my colleagues about how we strategize so we can address our own epidemic in a way that it deserves to be addressed. And that is, how do we begin to put together a domestic PEPFAR? Because that is what we need. That is what the that's exactly what we need. That's what the Black AIDS Institute is calling for. So we have a few opportunities, though, for action on some matters before we adjourn in September. Chairman Waxman, who's been a leader in so many efforts in terms of oversight and health care, he's going to hold a hearing on the new CDC incidence numbers in the Oversight and Government Reform Committee in early September. The Congressional Black Caucus's annual legislative conference, that will take place at the end of September. And in our annual HIV and AIDS Brain Trust, which I chair with Congresswoman Christensen, we will be talking about the impact of AIDS on the African American community. We need to explore what opportunities are available right now to provide increased funding to the CDC, which is severely underfunded. You need that $1.4 billion just to get started. I mean, that's just to get started. So we're going to talk about what we need to do and what we need to mount to begin a real prevention mission. So that's going to be discussed as soon as we return. Quite frankly, this is long overdue. You know, some of the ongoing flaws of PEPFAR, let me just say, provide us with certain lessons that we need to translate to our own response to AIDS in America. First, let me just say, we need to develop a single AIDS strategy. Secondly, let me just say it's shameful that 27 years into this global epidemic, that we don't have a national strategy. We don't have one. Like PEPFAR, such a strategy must orient our domestic AIDS response towards achieving clear and ambitious objectives. And I mean ambitious objectives in terms of reducing HIV infection rates, increasing access to care, and reducing racial and ethnic disparities. And we must insist on universal health care. We can't forget. That's part of our struggle in America. Universal health care. A PEPFAR for the United States should build stronger partnerships between communities and our public health service agencies. It should include a recommitment to rebuild our health care system and infrastructure in our country. And so those are part of the components that we must look at. And we all have to make a commitment to eliminate that federal ban on funding needle exchange programs. That needs to go. That needs to go. And our own domestic PEPFAR must include comprehensive sex education for our young people. Comprehensive. 70% of young people infected now are African American teenagers. 65% of newborn babies, African American newborns. My bill, I hope you know it, H.R. 1653, the Responsible Education About Life Act, it's Be For Real. That would repeal the abstinence-only policy of our own country and provide for comprehensive sex education. We did that in PEPFAR this year. We got rid of that 33% earmark. People told us we couldn't do it, and I said, yes, we can. We did it. We did it. And so we're going to have to commit to doing that on our own, in our own country, in our own domestic PEPFAR. So let me just say thank you again for being here. Thank you for the work that you do each and every day, because we never would be at this point with PEPFAR, the Global Fund, our Orphans and Vulnerable Children's Initiatives, CDC, our Minority AIDS Initiatives, our testing initiatives. This is, you know, it's almost the stars are almost lined up. They're aligned now, you know, and we've got to use this moment. It is a defining moment to pressure our own government, to pressure the Congress and the next president, and of course you know who I am supporting as the next president, you know. To insist and make sure that we develop our national AIDS strategy and plan and move forward and stamp HIV and AIDS from the face of the earth. Thank you again, and let me now take a moment and introduce our first panelist, Dr. Kevin Fenton, who most of you know, who's done a phenomenal job at CDC as the director of the National Center for HIV and AIDS, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention. Throughout his career, he has directed and established a number of research programs and forums related to HIV and AIDS and sexual health. This afternoon, Dr. Fenton will discuss trends and future challenges responding to HIV and AIDS in the United States. As a chief consultant in the VA, it was in their strategic health group. Excuse me. I'm going to wait and hold off on introducing our next panelist. I think Dr. Fenton should be introduced as Dr. Fenton first, and then we'll move on to our next panelist. Okay, so give Dr. Fenton a round of applause. And I want to thank him for being here with these new numbers. These new unfortunate numbers, but he's ready to deal with them, and he's got a deep commitment to beginning to help us turn this around. Thank you, Dr. Fenton.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this session, and thanks to the co-chairs for having invited me to be here for this session. This is an important time for us in the United States. It's a moment in time. There's been a wonderful confluence of focus not only on the domestic epidemic in the United States, but the global leadership that the U.S. is providing in HIV prevention. In the talk that I'll give today, I'm going to be focusing on the new figures for HIV in the United States. I'm going to be focusing on incidence in the United States. And as I speak today, I'd like you to pause and to think about these figures. Pause and think about what you're saying to us in the United States about where we need to be going with ending this epidemic within our lifetimes. It does not have to be this way. We need to ensure that HIV does not become a rite of passage for gay and bisexual men and for gay and bisexual men of all races in the U.S. We need to end the burden of HIV/AIDS among African-American communities and to end the burden of HIV/AIDS among Latinos in the United States. And we need to ensure that all of our young people in the United States grow up with the knowledge, the skills, and the confidence to prevent HIV infection throughout their lives. Over the next 10 minutes or so, I'm going to be focusing on three key areas. I'm going to be introducing the new incidence figures. I'm going to be walking through the methodology for assessing these incidence figures. We're going to be looking also at HIV prevalence, and then we're going to be talking critically about where do we go next, CDC's response, and opportunities that we will have for moving forward with this epidemic. So first of all, let's reflect on the epidemic and where we are with the U.S. epidemic. Great, thank you. So we're going to reflect on where we are with the epidemic today. Okay, I will. I'm being asked to increase the volume on the microphone as well, and I'll lean into the microphone. And I also need... Wonderful, thank you. Okay, so I'll recap. I'm going to focus on the HIV incidence figures. I'm going to also reflect on prevalence in the United States, and we look at the implications for prevention as well. So just as a bit of a recap, I'd like to just bring you back to where we were prior to the release of these data. Earlier estimates of HIV incidence were based on CUDA methods, on indirect methods. The first assessment was done in 1995, and at that time we thought that there were between 40 to 80,000 new HIV infections occurring within the United States. This estimate was later updated and reported in 2001, and this is the figure that most of you in the room are most aware of, the 40,000 new HIV infections occurring in the United States. For the new methods, which were published in JAMA on this week's Sunday, we used two approaches to assess HIV incidence in the United States. The first was a stratified extrapolation approach. This was based on ensuring that we had new surveillance information, standard HIV testing, and new HIV testing technologies, which were used to directly measure incidence in the United States. The new laboratory technique is called the STARS technique, and it combines an HIV test with a BED assay, which enables us to determine recent HIV infections within a five-month period. The BED assay and the STARS approach enables us to distinguish between long-standing HIV infections and new HIV infections. And therefore, by using this and complicated mathematical models, we were able to extrapolate to determine the number of new HIV infections which are occurring in the United States. We used a sample of 22 jurisdictions in the United States, and we used individuals who were, we worked with individuals who were newly diagnosed with HIV to perform the new laboratory approach, the STARS approach. The second method which we use that I'm going to be presenting today is the extended back calculation approach, and this enabled a retrospective view of the evolution of HIV incidence in the United States. And we were able to create a picture of the change in HIV incidence since 1977. The extended back calculation approach uses both AIDS surveillance data as well as HIV surveillance data as well as data on HIV testing patterns in the United States. This is a figure that all of you in the room should be aware of now. The highlight of the paper in JAMA was that in 2006, CDC estimated that there were 56,300 new HIV infections which occurred in the United States. This is approximately 40% higher than had been previously estimated. But as you will see in the presentation as I move forward, that this does not necessarily represent an increase in HIV incidence. In fact, the level of new infections have remained relatively stable since 1999. But 56,300 new HIV infections are too many in the United States today. So let's focus now on who are those individuals who are newly acquiring HIV in the United States. First, let's look by gender. 73% of the new HIV infections were among men and 27% among women. This slide shows data from the extended back calculation approach, and I'm going to walk through it so that you're very clear about what I'll be showing in subsequent slides related to the evolution of HIV in the United States. I'd like you to focus first on the green bar. This shows the total number of new HIV infections by year or year groups since 1977. And the data confirms that we saw a peak in HIV incidence in the mid-1980s. Between 1984 to the early 1990s, we saw a decline in HIV incidence, in part a result of population-wide responses to the HIV epidemic, but also in part to the differential mortality to individuals who were infected with HIV and died with advanced HIV disease. Between the early 1990s, we saw another uptick in HIV incidence occurring towards the mid to late 1990s, and since then, we've seen a stabilization in new HIV infections in the United States. The trend for men follows the general trend for the total population, in part because most of the new infections are actually occurring among men in the U.S. Again, a peak in the mid-1980s, a subsequent decline, and a relative stabilization since the late 1990s. In the pink, we show the trends for HIV incidence among women, a slightly later peak which occurred in the late 1980s, and stabilization to some declines since that period. Let's look at HIV incidence by the transmission category, and again, these are data for 2006. As you've heard, 53% of new HIV infections are occurring among men who have sex with men, about 31% among heterosexuals, and 12% among injecting drug users. Again, focusing your attention on the extended back calculation approach and the trends since 1977, we'll first look at the trends among men who have sex with men. We saw a peak in the mid-1980s and subsequent declines. But I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that the group, men who have sex with men are the only subgroup in the United States where we have seen consistent and sustained increases in HIV incidence since the early 1990s, and you can see the clear upward trend of HIV incidence since the early 1990s. Among injecting drug users, we saw two peaks occurring, one coterminous with the peaks among gay and bisexual men, and another which occurred slightly later in the early 1990s. And since that time, we have seen consistent declines in HIV incidence among injecting drug users. Among heterosexuals, a slightly delayed peak occurred, and we have seen a relative stabilization in incidence for most of the 1990s, a slight uptick towards the late 1990s, but some evidence of a decline since then. The third group that I'd like to focus on for HIV incidence is looking at the trends by race, ethnicity. And again, as you've heard today, we see the severe and disproportionate burden of new HIV infections which are occurring among minority communities in the United States. 45% of the 56,300 new HIV infections occurred among blacks in the United States, about 35% among whites, and 17% among Hispanics. And for those of you who are not from the United States, blacks and Hispanics account for approximately 13 to 15% of the U.S. population. So this really highlights the severe and disproportionate burden of disease which we see in these communities. With the race ethnicity data, we're actually able to assess the rates of new HIV infections for 2006 by applying these data to population data using the census data. Again, you see that the rates for new HIV infections in the United States are approximately 22.8 per 100,000. We see that rates among African Americans or blacks in the U.S. are nearly seven times as high as whites, and among Hispanics at 29.3 per 100,000, about three times as high as the rates among whites. Let's now focus on the trends over time for HIV incidence by race, ethnicity in the United States. Again, we begin with HIV infections among whites in the U.S., bearing in mind that the predominance of these infections were likely to be white gay men, especially at the beginning of the HIV epidemic. Again, we see consistent trends. We see the peak of HIV incidence, which occurred in the mid-1980s, the subsequent declines, and then a suggestion of sustained increases occurring since the early 1990s. Among blacks, we see a slightly delayed peak, which occurred in the early 1990s, declines in the mid-1990s, and uptick again in the late 1990s, but then relative stabilization in HIV incidence in the more recent time periods. Among Hispanics, we saw a peak in the mid to early late 1980s, and we have seen relative stabilization in the number of new HIV infections among Hispanics since that time. In this graph, I have separated out the numbers for Asian Pacific Islanders as well as for Alaska Natives and American Indians, in part because the numbers are relatively smaller than the other racial and ethnic groups in the United States. But again, the trends are quite startling, and you can see for Asian Pacific Islanders the peak, which occurred in the early to mid-1980s, and a second peak, which has occurred towards the late 1990s. There has been a gradual and sustained increase in incidence among Asian Pacific Islanders, the majority of whom we believe to be gay and bisexual men. And for American Indians and Alaska Natives, we again saw a similar peak occurring in the mid-80s, but relative stabilization in incidence over time. The final subgroup and subcategory I'll be focusing on today is the estimated percentage of new HIV infections which occurred by age. And what is startling here is the number of new HIV infections occurring in young people in the United States. The data estimates that approximately 34% of new HIV infections occurred in individuals less than 30 years, the majority of whom would be between 20 and 29 years of age. 31% were among 30 to 39 years, and a substantial proportion, another third, in individuals aged over 40 years. Again, we can look at rates by age group, and the data really confirm the disproportionate burden of disease among individuals aged 30 to 39 years in the United States. So those are the incidence data. I'm going to be moving on now briefly to discuss prevalent infections in the United States. The last estimate for prevalence was published in 2005, and at that time, CDC estimated that there were over a million people living with HIV in the United States, and the range for the prevalence estimate are highlighted there. What is particularly important to recognize about prevalent HIV infections is that we believe that approximately a quarter of these individuals remain undiagnosed, and this really suggests that there remains tremendous unmet need and opportunities for us to scale up our HIV testing promotion and activities in the United States. The prevalence data, we know prevalence of HIV in the United States is clearly not randomly distributed in the population, and I've included here data from an NHANES survey which looked at data between 1999 and 2006. I'd like to focus your attention on the red bar, which highlights the overall prevalence of HIV in the United States. And this is from a household survey for individuals aged 18 to 49 years. And this suggests that approximately 0.5% of Americans are HIV positive. But I'd like to draw your attention to the tremendous variations which we see in the U.S. population, whether by male-female ratio, the gender, where we see the preponderance of prevalent disease among men, whether by age, where we see increasing prevalence with increasing age in the United States, and certainly, and perhaps unsurprisingly, the disparities which we see by race ethnicity. But I'd like to draw your attention that in this population-based survey of household respondents, we saw prevalence of 2% among non-Hispanic blacks in the United States, and approximately 0.3% among Mexican Americans who were included in this survey. In terms of AIDS diagnoses and cumulative deaths, we know that since the beginning of this epidemic, we've lost more than 565,000 Americans to this epidemic. These are our brothers, these are our sisters, these are our family members, our peers, our friends. In 2006 alone, we continue to see in the United States more than 14,000 individuals dying from HIV/AIDS, in part because these individuals were diagnosed too late, in part because of the stigma and discrimination which are still serious and severe in the United States. And we know from our data that more than a third of individuals who are diagnosed with HIV develop AIDS within a year of that HIV diagnosis. This suggests that we do have unmet needs in ensuring that we're testing people earlier and people are able, who are positive, are able to avail themselves of the effective antiretroviral therapy. So in the final few minutes of my presentation, what I'd like to do is to focus on the implications for prevention. And I know that this is going to be on your hearts and on your minds as we reflect on the panel today. Firstly, I think there's some challenges that these data are confirming. The fact that we still have a quarter of individuals with HIV in the United States who remain undiagnosed are a huge challenge to us. We know from the data that men who sex with men remain at increased HIV risk and new infections are increasing. And in fact, MSM are the only group where we're seeing consistent increases in incidence in the United States. The data confirm the disproportionate burden of disease among African Americans and Hispanics. And we know that there are concerns about limited access to effective prevention, whether this is the proportion of individuals who are HIV testing in the U.S., whether it is the coverage of our prevention programs, whether it is the penetration of our prevention programs within communities. And we also know that there's tremendous concern about complacency regarding HIV, AIDS, and prevention within our society. And this complacency cuts across all sectors of society and will be one of the main challenges that we will have moving forward. Other challenges have been spoken about quite clearly at this conference, that stigma and discrimination are real. It's a stigma and discrimination against HIV testing, against those living with HIV, against people who are diagnosed with HIV, who are afraid to access effective treatment and care because they do not want to be seen going to the nearest HIV clinic. We know about issues of the coterminous epidemics of substance abuse, which is rife among sectors of our communities, which are driving epidemics of HIV in the United States today. We know about the internet as a means of facilitating partner change and acquisition, but also the tremendous opportunities that the internet provides for us for enhancing our prevention efforts. And finally, we know that we need to have more culturally competent interventions moving forward. And part of that cultural competency will be looking at interventions to focus on structural factors which address poverty, which address housing, which address racism, and which address homophobia, and which address homelessness in our society. Now, I couldn't end this presentation without briefly reflecting on CDC's response, and I know we'll have time to talk about this in the discussion. But very briefly, we have already begun to respond to these data. These data are a wake-up call. There are no surprises. They confirm what we knew before regarding the disproportionate burden of disease. And they're a wake-up call to all of us, collectively and individually, about enhancing our prevention efforts. CDC has already begun to expand HIV testing, and I'll be happy to speak about this in more detail as we look at increasing our fiscal investments in HIV testing. We're committed to expanding access to effective programs, to mobilizing at-risk communities, especially African American, Latino, and now we will be focusing specifically on the MSM communities and leaders within the MSM community moving forward. We're reassessing our efforts for prevention with men who sex with men and other hardest hit communities, and we're conducting research on new interventions. But as we move forward, there are many other things on our agenda for taking forward and responding to these data. We hear the calls for a national HIV plan, and CDC is supportive and wants to be an active player and an active contributor to that national HIV plan. And we're hoping that that will be a reality in the near future. We are committed to reviewing our prevention portfolio, and we are committed to doing this by an independent panel of national experts to ensure that we're doing the right things, that we're targeting those things in the right ways, and we're looking at opportunities for scaling up our prevention efforts moving forward. And as part of this review of our prevention portfolio, we are committed to developing a new strategic roadmap for HIV prevention with measurable and bold objectives leading us to 2020. So with that, I'd like to bring the presentation to a close. I'd like to thank my CDC colleagues who've worked tremendously on getting these data out in a timely manner, in a manner which really ensures that we have accurate and reliable data. data that we are confident about, and a new system of surveillance and measuring HIV incidence in the United States that will ensure that we have better clarity on the epidemic and can ensure that we now know how better to evaluate and to enhance our prevention responses moving forward. Thank you very much.
I want to thank our protesters for keeping the session alive and real and focusing on what has to happen. So thank you, protesters. Thank you, Dr. Fenton. Our next speaker is Dr. Ron Valdeseri, who, as Chief Consultant in the Veterans Administration Strategic Healthcare Group, directs VA programs that relate to public health policies across the VA healthcare system. Prior to joining the VA, Dr. Valdeseri served as Deputy Director for CDC's National Center for HIV, STDs, and TB Prevention. He will present on the HIV AIDS epidemic among MSMs in the United States. Dr. Valdeseri.
Thank you very much. If we can get someone up here who can put my slides on. We'll get started in a minute. Here we go. There we go. Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I would like to thank the organizers of the session for inviting me to overview the HIV/AIDS epidemic among men who have sex with men, or MSM, in the United States. And throughout this presentation, I will use the acronym MSM to include all men who engage in same-sex behavior, regardless of their sexual identity. Thus, the term encompasses gay men, bisexual men, and homosexually active, straight-identified men. I guess we use this. Great. Kevin Fenton provided an overview of epidemic trends in the United States, including the very important and highly relevant new incidence estimates. Now, let's take a closer look at specific trends in AIDS cases among men who have sex with men. This bar graph shows that the number of AIDS cases among MSM in the United States peaked in 1992 and decreased through 2001. However, between 2001 and 2005, the number of new AIDS diagnoses among MSM in the United States increased. This line graph attests to significant changes in the racial ethnic composition of MSM with AIDS in the United States. We see a dramatic decline in AIDS diagnoses among non-Hispanic white men throughout most of the 1990s and increases in diagnoses among black and Hispanic men. What can we say about more recent trends? As this pie chart shows, MSM accounted for the single largest transmission category, or 43.5%, of 36,790 new AIDS cases reported in the United States in 2006. A smaller percentage of new AIDS cases, 5%, were reported in MSM who injected drugs. In this slide, we are looking at 2006 data from 33 states with mature reporting systems, meaning that they've had confidential name-based HIV reporting since at least 2003. Here we see that of the over 35,000 HIV/AIDS diagnoses made in 2006, half were among MSM, and 3% were among MSM who inject drugs. The next two pie charts portray age distribution and race ethnicity among the over 97,000 MSM who were diagnosed with HIV/AIDS during the years of 2001 through 2006 in 33 U.S. states with HIV name reporting. As demonstrated, HIV/AIDS is diagnosed in all ages of men, but the majority of MSM diagnosed, nearly two-thirds, were between the ages of 25 and 44 years. In terms of race ethnicity, whites accounted for 42% of diagnoses, blacks for 36% of diagnoses, and Hispanics for 19% of diagnoses. Asian Pacific Islanders and American Indians and Alaska Natives were 1% and less than 1%, respectively, of all diagnoses. Now, because we do not know the total number of MSM in each racial and ethnic group, we cannot generate MSM-specific rates of disease burden by racial ethnic group. However, the disproportionate burden of HIV/AIDS among MSM of color is obvious when we consider racial ethnic distribution in the general U.S. population. Namely, while blacks represent 13% of the overall U.S. population, black men account for 36% of HIV/AIDS diagnoses among MSM. Likewise, Hispanics account for 14% of the overall U.S. population, yet 19% of MSM with HIV/AIDS are Hispanic. A recent analysis by the CDC compared estimated annual percentage changes, or EAPCs, of HIV/AIDS diagnoses among MSM in 33 states between 2001 and 2006. While EAPCs decreased for injecting drug users and high-risk heterosexuals, they increased for MSM. Among MSM of all ages, significant EAPC increases were seen in blacks, Hispanics, and Asian Pacific Islanders. The largest EAPC increase was seen in MSM 13 to 24 years old, especially young black men. Data such as these, and obviously the data presented by Kevin, have raised serious concerns about a resurgent HIV/AIDS epidemic among men who have sex with men in the United States. Now, what do we know about MSM behaviors that would help us understand factors that may contribute to increases in HIV infection rates? Useful information comes from the CDC's National HIV Behavioral Surveillance System, or NHBS. Using ethnographic techniques, the NHBS interviewed over 10,000 HIV uninfected MSM from a variety of venues in 17 metropolitan areas in the United States between November 2003 and April 2005. MSM reported very high rates of HIV testing, with 90% reporting that they had ever been tested, and 77% reporting testing in the last 12 months. While this is a positive health behavior, testing by itself is not a magic bullet against HIV infection, and other studies have revealed unrecognized HIV infection as a serious issue among MSM, especially MSM of color. Directly relevant to our understanding of increased HIV infection among U.S. MSM is the observation of high rates of anal intercourse without condom use. 47% of the men surveyed reported having unprotected anal sex with a male partner during the preceding 12 months. Peer norms around safer sex, especially condom-protected anal intercourse, are simply not as robust as they were in the first two decades of the American epidemic. Further, as this survey reveals, at-risk MSM do not appear to be receiving adequate levels of proactive HIV prevention. Only 15 and 8%, respectively, reported participating in individual and group level HIV programs in the last year. Drug and alcohol use, especially non-injection drug use, continue to be correlates of unsafe sexual behavior among MSM. Over 40% of MSM surveyed reported non-injection drug use in the past 12 months. Although not the only drug of concern, several studies have shown a clear association between methamphetamine use and HIV seroconversion among urban MSM in the United States. In summary, epidemiologic data, including trends in sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis and gonorrhea, indicate an increase in high-risk sexual behaviors among MSM and support the concern that incident HIV infections are increasing among some populations of MSM in the United States. As this slide summarizes, there are a number of factors associated with resurgent HIV infection among MSM. Two that have not yet been touched upon and deserve specific mention are the ongoing stigmatization of same-sex behavior in the United States, as well as the general population attitude that HIV/AIDS is no longer a major public health issue nor a serious health threat in the United States. This data and these numbers mean very little if we do not use them to improve and enhance our efforts to prevent HIV infection among the various populations of MSM living in the United States. As such, it is very important that we continue to inform funders and policymakers that HIV prevention is scientifically proven to be effective and is cost-saving. And most importantly, effective HIV prevention programs can spare successive generations of MSM from what remains an incurable, lifelong disease. Our strategy to ensure effective HIV prevention efforts for MSM in the United States must rely on men being aware of their current HIV serostatus. In this study of MSM from five American cities, nearly half of the infected men were unaware of their infection. An unrecognized infection was especially high among non-whites and men younger than 30 years of age. Promoting routine HIV testing in healthcare settings and developing culturally sensitive, community-based programs for MSM are two important ways to achieve this goal. But testing alone will not end this epidemic. We must continue to implement evidence-based interventions for uninfected MSM, as well as those who are already diagnosed and living with HIV. And once these interventions are tested and proven to be effective, it is essential that they be replicated at a level and scale that will ensure effective dosage. Sadly, a recent study conducted in four American cities found that among nearly 4,000 HIV-infected persons, only one-third had received any prevention services in the last 3 months. And MSM were especially likely to have gone without such services, even though they were more likely to report risk behaviors. Finally, in the words of Nobel laureate Mother Teresa, to keep a lamp burning, we have to keep pouring oil into it. And by this I mean it is imperative that as a nation, the United States continue to invest in HIV prevention research, both biomedical and behavioral. Further, this investment cannot stop at the level of publication, but must extend to include efforts to better understand how to replicate and operationalize effective interventions, especially for racial and ethnic minorities. Thank you.
you very much. Now we are privileged to hear from a real expert on adolescent and teenagers, Dr. Laura Kahn. Dr. Kahn is with the Division of Adolescent and School Health at CDC's National Center for Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion. She will describe trends in HIV-related risk behaviors among United States adolescents. Thank you very much, Dr. Kahn, for being here.
Thank you to the organizers for the opportunity to present these data, and thank you for the kind introduction. I think you'll see by the end of this presentation that this is another version of the wake-up call that Dr. Fenton just described. The purpose of this presentation is to examine changes in sexual risk behaviors among high school students in the U.S. from 91 to 07. We did this by using data from CDC's National Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which biennially measures the six categories of priority health risk behaviors listed on this slide among adolescents generally ages 14 to 17 who attend school. For this presentation, we examine trends in four HIV-related risk behaviors: ever having had sexual intercourse with four or more persons, current sexual activity, and condom use at last sexual intercourse. To identify possible disparities in secular trends, we looked at five subgroups of students: females, males, white, not Hispanic students, black or African American, not Hispanic students, hereafter referred to as black students, and Hispanic or Latino students who might be of any race, hereafter referred to as Hispanic students. We used data from nine national youth risk behavior surveys conducted from 91 to 07. Each survey used an independent three-stage cluster sample. We first selected schools with probability proportional to size and then randomly selected classrooms to participate. All students in selected classes were included. To allow for separate analyses, black and Hispanic students were oversampled at each stage. Data are representative of all public and private school students in grades 9 through 12 in all 50 states. This slide shows the sample sizes and response rates and how they varied across the nine national youth risk behavior surveys. Sample sizes ranged from nearly 11,000 to over 16,000. Survey administration procedures were designed to protect students' privacy by allowing for anonymous and voluntary participation. Before survey administration, local parental permission procedures were followed. Students completed a self-administered questionnaire during one class period and recorded their responses directly on a computer scannable booklet. A weight based on students' sex, race, ethnicity, and grade was applied to each record to adjust for non-response and oversampling of black and Hispanic students. Trends over time were analyzed using logistic regression analyses, which controlled for sex, race, ethnicity, and grade, and also simultaneously assessed both linear and quadratic time effects. Trends that include both significant linear and quadratic components demonstrate an overall increase or decrease over time, plus some nonlinear variation within the overall increase or decrease. Cross-sectional subgroup differences were analyzed for statistical significance using t-tests. Now let's turn to the results. For each of the four risk behaviors, I'll begin by showing cross-sectional data from 07 by subgroup, and then three slides that describe trends overall, and then by sex and by race ethnicity. Nationwide, in 07, 48% of high school students had ever had sexual intercourse during their life. The prevalence of sexual intercourse was higher among male than female students, higher among black and Hispanic than white students, and higher among black than Hispanic students. This slide shows the prevalence of sexual experience over time. From 91 to 07, sexual experience decreased 12%. A linear decrease also was detected among female students, shown in red, and male students, shown in yellow. In addition, among male students, the prevalence of sexual experience declined from 91 to 97 and then leveled off from 97 to 07. Among white students shown in blue and black students shown in orange, a linear decrease was detected. Among black students, a quadratic trend also was detected, indicating that sexual experience declined from 91 to 01 and then leveled off from 01 to 07. Among Hispanic students shown in green, no change was detected. Moving to the next behavior, nationwide in 07, 15% of high school students had had sexual intercourse with four or more sex partners during their life. The prevalence of having multiple sex partners was higher among male than female students, and once again higher among black and Hispanic than white students, and higher among black than Hispanic students. This slide shows the percentage of high school students who had multiple sex partners. From 91 to 07, the overall prevalence of this behavior decreased 20%. A linear decrease also was detected among female and male students. In addition, among male students, a quadratic trend also was detected. The prevalence of multiple sex partners among male students declined from 91 to 97 and then leveled off from 97 to 07. Among black and white students, the prevalence of multiple sex partners decreased from 91 to 07. However, among Hispanic students, once again, no change was detected. Moving now to current sexual activity. In 2007, 35% of high school students had had sexual intercourse with at least one person during the 3 months before the survey. The prevalence of current sexual activity was higher among black and Hispanic than white students and higher among black than Hispanic students. This slide shows the percentage of high school students over time who reported current sexual activity. From 91 to 07, this behavior decreased 7% overall. However, no changes were detected among male and female students when examined separately, and no changes were detected in current sexual activity among white or Hispanic students. Among black students, the prevalence of current sexual activity decreased from 91 to 07. And finally, in 07, among the currently sexually active students, 62% reported that either they or their partner had used a condom during last sexual intercourse. The prevalence of having used a condom was higher among male than female students and higher among black than white students. This slide shows that the percentage of high school students who used a condom increased 33% from 91 to 07. In addition, a quadratic change was identified indicating that condom use rates also leveled off within this overall decrease from 03 to 07. A linear increase in condom use was also detected among male and female students. In addition, among female students, a quadratic trend was detected, indicating that condom use also increased from 91 to 03 and then leveled off from 03 to 07. Among white, black, and Hispanic students, a linear increase in condom use was detected. However, among black students, once again, a quadratic trend also was detected. This is a summary of the data I just reported by behavior and subgroup. A single arrow box indicates a linear increase or decrease only, or level rates, no change at all from 91 to 07. Two arrows in a box indicate a quadratic change in addition to a linear increase or decrease. In these instances, the behavior went up or down and then leveled off more recently, in addition to an overall increase or decrease. Focusing then on just the first row of data, it tells us that progress has been made during the past 17 years in decreasing overall the prevalence of sexual experience, multiple sex partners and current sexual activity, and in increasing the prevalence of condom use. However, even though condom use rates have increased since 91, since 03, no additional progress has been made. Further, though I did not show these data, no changes were noted for any behavior between 05 and 07 overall or among any subgroup of students. Further, if we look at the three highlighted rows on this slide, it shows that among male students, black students, and Hispanic students, there is further cause for concern. Since among male students, sexual experience and multiple sex partners has been level since 97, and current sexual activity has not changed at all. Among black students, sexual experience has not decreased since 01, and condom use has not increased since 99. And black students have significantly higher rates of sexual risk behaviors than white or Hispanic students. And among Hispanic students, no changes at all have occurred in sexual experience, multiple sex partners, or current sexual activity since 1991. At least three limitations should be noted. First, these data, of course, only apply to youth who attend school and therefore are not representative of all persons in this age group. Nationwide in the U.S. in 2005, of persons aged 16 to 17 years, approximately 3% were not enrolled in a high school program and had not completed high school. Among subgroups of youth, the percentage of youth not enrolled and who have not completed high school is much higher. Second, the extent of under- or over-reporting of behaviors cannot be determined, although the survey questions demonstrate good test-retest reliability. And third, the National YRBS only asks about a very limited number of sexual behaviors and does not tell us anything about why students do or do not practice sexual risk behaviors. Clearly, renewed efforts are critically needed to delay onset of sexual activity and to increase condom use once students become sexually active. This is especially true for male, black, and Hispanic students. And these efforts need to involve parents and families, schools, youth-serving community organizations, healthcare providers, the media, government, and, of course, youth themselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ken. Our next presenter is Dr. Gina Wingood, a full professor at Emory University Rollins School of Public Health. Dr. Wingood's research explores strategies to reduce the high-risk sexual behavior among African-American women and develop efficacious interventions in preventing HIV. Please welcome Dr. Wingood.
Good afternoon, and some assistance with the slide set. Good afternoon. Thank you, David. Thank you, Congresswoman, for all of your efforts. Thank you very much. Also, thank you, everybody here, for allowing me to present on African-American women. I'm presenting on the efficacy of a trial to reduce incident non-viral STIs as well as high-risk HPV among African-American women. I'd like to thank my colleagues who have worked day, night, evening, morning, and every other day to actually reduce to work with me on this study. Thank you for all your efforts. The rate of HIV diagnosis among all U.S. women is 12.2 per 100,000. Among African-American women, it's 60.2 per 100,000. Astonishing and sad. Among women in the U.S., marked racial as well as regional disparities exist. Specifically, women in the deep southern U.S. are severely affected. Currently, among all U.S. women, one-third of new HIV infections are diagnosed among women in the Deep South, with African-American women being diagnosed disproportionately. Traditionally, HIV interventions for women have focused on enhancing condom penile vaginal sex. However, more novel HIV interventions are incorporated. They need to offer a range of female-initiated as well as female-controlled safer sex choices. This is particularly important for women at risk, African-American women residing in the Deep South. You may ask, where is the Deep South? I'm from Massachusetts. I didn't know anything about the Deep South. So where is the Deep South? The Deep South is actually the southern belt of the U.S. It includes the states of Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Mississippi. To address these racial disparities, we designed a study called STARS. STARS is an acronym called Sisters Talking About Real Solutions. The objective of STARS is to test the efficacy of a program for African-American women living in Georgia, a deep southern state. The primary outcomes are to reduce incident STIs, specifically chlamydia, gonorrhea, and trichomoniasis, as well as to reduce unprotected sexual intercourse. We want to look at a range of secondary outcomes. Specifically, we want to look at incident HPV, types 16 and 18. HPV is also quite prevalent among women, and what we're trying to do is also occurs sexually. We want to reduce high-risk HPV. We want to reduce multiple male sexual partners. non-insertive or non-penetrative sexual intercourse. We want to actually enhance this. We want to look at STI testing practices, douching practices, which are very prevalent, particularly among African-American women in the South and are associated with STIs. Partner selection practices, something other, again, than condom use. And, of course, psychosocial mediators, such as knowledge, condom use self-efficacy. The study sample was recruited at a health maintenance organization. A database was obtained from this organization, and we randomly selected women from this list to participate in the study. Eligibility criteria included being an African-American female, 18 to 29 years of age, providing written informed consent, as well as reporting having unprotected vaginal sex in the prior 6 months. This was a randomized trial study design. The population of African-American women were screened. They had to be between the ages of 18 to 29 and sexually active. At baseline, 6 and 12 months follow-up, women completed an ACASI that assessed self-report behaviors, demographics, and mediators. Additionally, women provided vaginal swabs for STI analysis for chlamydia, gonorrhea, trichomoniasis, and HPV. Women were randomized to 1 to 2 study conditions, the HIV intervention, which was 2 sessions, with each session being 4 hours in length, or a comparison condition, which focused on general health promotion. The content of the HIV intercession was 2 sessions. The first session talked about fostering ethnic and gender pride. What that talked about is really enhancing self-esteem, self-awareness, and self-worth in being an African-American female. We know that many women in this age group have high rates of abuse or histories of abuse. Therefore, as part of this session, we talked about healthy and unhealthy relationships. We defined abuse and talked about how abuse can lead to HIV risk-taking and potentially HIV acquisition. We discussed a range of prevention options. We described it as the AMOR prevention package. Each letter in AMOR stood for a prevention strategy. A stood for abstaining from unsafe sex and douching. M stand for mutual stimulation, enhancing non-penetrative sex. O stood for oral sex, however protected oral sex. U stood for uninfected partner, encouraging partner STI testing. And R stood for regular use of condoms, which we talked about consistent and proper condom use as having a reduced number of partners. Session 2 actually reinforced these activities via role plays, as well as talked about partner selection. Analyses were conducted using intention to treat analyses. At baseline, we compared both conditions on demographics, sexual behaviors, mediators of safer sex. Covariates were identified. We employed logistic and linear regression, as well as GEE, to assess for repeated measures. I'm going to ignore that. So see, demographics mentioned that on average, women were 24 years of age. Also, a majority were in relationships. Specifically, more than 85% of the women were in relationships. And also, these relationships were long-term relationships. Women were in relationships for almost 2 years. And we know that it's much harder to change your HIV risk practices when you're in a long-term relationship. Looking at the results, participation rate for the study was 85%. The intervention session was implemented with fidelity, with 99% of intervention activities being completed. Most of the women, 96%, came to 2 of the intervention sessions. Over 70% of women completed 6 as well as 12-month follow-up assessments in the intervention condition. The comparison condition was also completed. 99% of the activities were completed with fidelity, and we had relatively high or moderate to high 6-month and 12-month retention rates. So let's look closer at the results and specifically, what was the effect of SARS in reducing incident biological outcomes? This is looking at the effect of SARS on reducing non-viral STIs, high-risk HPV, as well as what we call any STI, which is a combination of all of these STIs. specifically women who were in the intervention condition, were a third less likely to acquire a new non-viral STI. Additionally, they were two-thirds less likely to acquire high-risk HPV. That's type 16 as well as type 18. Let's look at how SARS was effective in terms of reducing behavioral outcomes. I look at these outcomes in relation to the Amore strategic model. Women in the intervention were less likely to douche or more likely to abstain from douching. They were more likely to advise their main partner of getting their STI test results. They were also more likely to ask their main partner to get an STI test. The women were also much more likely to practice non-penetrative sex, such as masturbation. They were more likely to practice oral sex. They also were more likely to reduce having multiple sexual partners, having a casual sexual partner, and also were more likely to select a male partner who wanted children. Let's look at some of how the intervention impacted psychosocial outcomes, or mediators of safer sex. Women in the intervention had greater or higher knowledge scores. They had higher scores on condom use self-efficacy. And they had reduced barriers to safer sex. This trial demonstrates that a two-session HIV intervention can reduce high-risk HPV incidents, non-viral STIs such as chlamydia, gonorrhea, and trichomoniasis, and can enhance safer sex practices and mediators of safer sex among a sample of African-American women who are in relatively long-term relationships. The intervention effects may be attributable to providing women a package of female-controlled or female-initiated safer sex options and allowing them to combine these strategies. Encouraging consistent condom use, as we do in many studies, is very important. However, for this prevention strategy to be effective, it has to be adopted. In this study, we offered a prevention package that included behavioral options such as douching, partner selection, consistent condom use, and non-penetrative sex. We looked at biomedical options as well, such as encouraging partner STI testing, as well as social options such as partner selection. A single prevention strategy may not be feasible, practical, or even realistic. Future HIV interventions for women may consider expanding their options for safer sex and offering prevention packages. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wingood. Let me encourage as many who can stay to please stay, because after our final panelists, we'll be opening for a few questions and answers. Now we will hear from Daniel Gitter of CDC's Global AIDS Program. He will present data on a study exploring the connection between housing status and HIV risk behavior. Thank you very much, Daniel, for being here. Look forward
to it. Thank you very much. Good afternoon. It's truly an honor to be presenting at this conference and with such a distinguished panel. When I was thinking about this distinguished panel and the topics that they would be discussing, I was wondering how I could raise the profile of what I was going to talk about. So I thought to myself, well, President Bill Clinton is talking this week. Maybe he can talk about homelessness and HIV in the U.S. And I thought to myself, well, that may not be enough. How about if during his speech, while he's talking about homelessness and HIV, there are people who walk in front of the stage holding signs about homeless people living with HIV and AIDS? Then, as an additional part, maybe they could march for a couple of days during the conference. Well, all that did occur, so I'm glad that all of you have heard of this issue and are here to listen to my presentation on this topic. But in all seriousness, I think this is an issue that is receiving much more attention, especially in the last few years. And so without further ado, let me begin my presentation. Okay. Is that better? I'd first like to thank my co-authors on this project, Drs. Rich Wolitsky, Sherry Powles, and Michael Campsmith. Determining the numbers of homeless people in the U.S. is difficult. Homelessness is often episodic, with people cycling in and out of homelessness, And there are those who are chronically homeless, who are living on the streets or in other places not meant for human habitation, and thus are difficult to locate and count. Social and economic factors associated with HIV in the U.S. are also associated with homelessness, including being male, black, using substances, having mental health issues, lack of education, and a history of physical or sexual abuse. And homeless persons also have more chronic diseases and physical health problems than the general population. Homeless persons are more likely than stably housed persons to engage in HIV risk behaviors, including injection drug use, risky sexual practices, and engaging in sex for money, drugs, or a place to stay. So perhaps not surprisingly, HIV/AIDS diagnosis rates are 3 to 9 times higher in homeless persons compared with those in stable housing. And these differences in rates are due to differences in sample characteristics and locations where data were collected. Yet few studies have conducted research at the intersection of these two groups, which are homeless people living with HIV or AIDS. And most of the studies have been single site and small scale. So the goals of the study were we used bivariate analyses to examine the differences between homeless and housed people living with HIV and AIDS on HIV sexual transmission risk behaviors and substance use risk behaviors. We used multivariate analyses to examine the independent effects of homelessness and on sex and substance use risk, controlling for potentially confounding factors. The study was a secondary analysis of the U.S. CDC's Supplement to HIV/AIDS Surveillance, or SHAS, project, which is a behavioral survey of adults recently diagnosed with HIV or AIDS in the U.S. It extends information routinely collected in AIDS surveillance. It's a cross-sectional survey and was conducted in multiple sites. These are the participating sites. There were 19 health departments across the U.S. that participated in this project. Some recruitment occurred across states and others in certain facilities or cities. 10 health departments conducted population-based sampling. Those are shown here in red. And 9 health departments conducted facility-based sampling in yellow. Their information was collected across a variety of domains through individual interviews. The SHAS data were collected from 1990 to 2003. The current study includes data from May 2000 to December 2003 from persons who had valid housing data, and this was 8,075 people. Housing status was based on respondents' living situation at the time of the interview. Persons were homeless if they reported living in a homeless shelter or on the streets. This was 4% of the sample. And the house respondents were those living in a house, an apartment, a medical care facility, or a correctional institution, and this was the remaining 96%. This slide shows bivariate analyses comparing the homeless and the housed groups. We used chi-squares for categorical variables and t-tests for continuous variables. Those in yellow are the variables in which there were significant differences between homeless and housed groups. As you can see here, the average age was 40 for both groups and was not significantly different between groups. The sample was mostly male, with significantly more male homeless respondents. It was mostly black in both groups. The homeless had a lower education, with nearly half having lower than high school education. The homeless were also more likely to be unemployed, with 90% unemployment. And perhaps not surprisingly, the homeless were more likely to have a yearly income of less than $10,000. They were also less likely to be married. These are the bivariate sexual behavior analyses. Although the housed were significantly more likely to be sexually active, the homeless were more likely to have had a greater number of sex partners in their lifetime and in the past year, and almost half of the homeless had exchanged sex in their lifetime and were more likely to have exchanged sex in the past 12 months. Homeless were also more likely to have had unprotected vaginal or anal sex and last sex with an unknown serostatus partner. For substance use bivariate analyses, there were significant differences between homeless and housed on all of the substance use variables. The possible alcohol abuse was the CAGE scale, which is a widely used standardized screening tool for possible lifetime alcohol abuse. And nearly 60% of the homeless had used drugs in the past 12 months. Nearly twice as many homeless reported ever injecting drugs, and among those who had ever injected, nearly half of the homeless had done so in the past year. In order to examine the independent effects of housing status, we conducted multivariate logistic regression analyses using the dependent variables, the sex risk and substance use variables that I just mentioned. And we controlled for sociodemographic and HIV risk group factors that are often associated with homelessness. The sociodemographic factors were age, gender, race, ethnicity, marital status, education, income, and employment. And the HIV risk group variables were men who have sex with men, injection drug use, MSM and IDU, and high-risk heterosexuals. And the goal of these analyses was to examine whether housing status was significantly associated with sex and drug risk behaviors even after controlling these factors. So is housing status significant above and beyond these factors? Each of these are the sexual behavior regression analyses, and each of these were separate multivariate regression analyses controlling for the factors that I just mentioned, presenting the adjusted odds ratios and the 95% confidence intervals for the homeless compared with the house groups for each analysis. So for this first one, I don't know if this is going to work. Since 1.0 falls within the lower and upper bound of the 95% confidence interval, housing was not significantly associated with sexual activity in the past 12 months. However, housing was a significant predictor of the remaining sex variables, including the homeless had 1.5 times the odds of the housed respondents of having greater than 9 partners in their lifetime, as well as higher odds of having more than one partner within the last year. The homeless also had nearly 2.5 times the odds of ever exchanging sex and nearly 3 times the odds of exchanging sex in the past year. The homeless also had 2 times the odds of unprotected sex with an unknown status partner. It is possible that these sex risk behaviors would be associated with substance use variables, as substance use and risky sex behaviors often occur together. So we reran these analyses, also controlling for alcohol and drug use, and all of these remain significant except for the lifetime number of partners. For the substance use regression analyses, all of the substance use regression analyses were significant, with homeless having greater odds of substance use, including 1.6 times the odds of possible alcohol abuse, over 2 times the odds of recent drug use, nearly 2 times the odds of ever injecting drugs, and over 2.5 times the odds of recent injection drug use among those who had ever injected. So in summary, compared to the housed respondents, homeless had greater odds of having more sex partners, having exchanged sex for money or drugs, having unprotected sex with an unknown status partner, having possible alcohol abuse, having used drugs, and having injected drugs, even after controlling for possible sociodemographic and HIV risk group confounding factors that might be associated with housing status. There are some limitations for this study. This was conducted only in a limited number of locations, so SHAS is not representative of all people living with HIV or AIDS in the U.S., and some sites only interviewed people with AIDS, which may produce different results than interviewing those with HIV. This is also not a study of homeless people, so we don't have detailed information about homelessness, such as the amount of time that they were homeless. In addition, homeless were only included by chance. The sampling may underrepresent the number of homeless people living with HIV or AIDS because homeless persons are often some of the most difficult persons to locate. These were also self-report data and thus subject to recall biases in socially desirable responding, and there's no way to verify the data that was reported. This is also a cross-sectional study, so we cannot determine which came first, the homelessness or the HIV risk factors. Homeless people living with HIV or AIDS in the U.S. experience more challenges than housed people living with HIV or AIDS. Yet little research has been reported on homeless people living with HIV or AIDS in the U.S. This is the first large multi-site study investigating HIV risk behaviors among homeless people living with HIV or AIDS. As mentioned previously, the 4% of people living with HIV or AIDS reporting being homeless in this sample may be a low estimate. However, even using this figure of 4% means that of the estimated 1+ million people living with HIV or AIDS in the U.S., there are potentially tens of thousands who are homeless. Thus, the results indicate the importance of screening for housing status and the importance of behavioral interventions for people living with HIV or AIDS. and homeless people living with HIV or AIDS should be a special priority for substance abuse and HIV prevention programs. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Kidder. I want to thank my incredible co-moderator and our distinguished panel, and especially want to thank you, Dr. Fenton, but not for the data that you presented, which I have to admit took way too long to release. This is data that we needed a year ago when it was ready. If we'd had it in October, the president might have had second thoughts about calling for a $1 million decrease in HIV prevention services. Congressional appropriations committees might have not recommended flat funding for HIV prevention for the Minority AIDS Initiative. Colleagues of our distinguished member of Congress here might have taken action on her bills that are pending, the REAL Act to end abstinence-only funding, the Justice Act to make sure that there's condoms available in federal prisons, that we actually take responses. It's very disappointing to be at this conference and hear so many things that are wrong, and yet we are not hearing enough solutions. And that's why I really want to thank you for endorsing the National AIDS Strategy. We do need a National AIDS Strategy. We need one that's outcome-based, that has clear goals and objectives, that's coordinated across the federal government, and includes all agencies, including all the agencies under HHS. That's CDC, NIH, HRSA, SAMHSA, CMS, and the Veterans Administration, the Department of Justice, HUD, Homeland Security, Labor. We need a comprehensive response. And we need all of you, the American public, to call on Senators Obama and McCain to make this happen. There's going to be so many priorities moving forward. This may not happen, and we may be here, or we may be in similar meetings in 2 years, having the same discussions and seeing even worse data. So that's why we really thank you, Dr. Fenton, for agreeing to the National AIDS Strategy. We want to ask you to really raise your voice with your colleagues in the federal government. And we actually have a T-shirt for you. We want to encourage everyone to go to nationalaidsstrategy.org. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Nikki Manguli from Advocates for Youth in Washington, D.C. And once again, I just wanted to thank Barbara Lee for being such an incredible advocate for young people everywhere. But my question is for all panel members. Have you made a commitment at the Youth Commitments Desk at the Youth Pavilion in the Global Village yet?
Not yet.
No.
We haven't yet, but we'll be going there en masse, I'm sure, after this to look at the and see what commitments we can make. Thank you for bringing that to my attention.
Hello, my name is Richard Zaldivar. I'm from Los Angeles, from the Wallace Memorias Project, and I want to applaud all of you and the tremendous work that you do. But I need to be honest with you. Coming here from Los Angeles, I'm Mexican-American, coming to Mexico, very impressed with the work that they're doing here. But coming to a session to receive an update on HIV/AIDS in the United States, I feel like I'm left out. I know that when we come to conferences, when we look at HIV/AIDS, we look at categories. We look at subcategories. But you know what? We're not looking at the whole story in the United States. We're not looking at the migrant issues. We're not looking at people in Mexico and the migration from Latin America and how that impacts HIV/AIDS. Until that's in there, I'm absent. My people are absent. I say that because I'm extremely passionate that the HIV/AIDS response should be included of all people. Puerto Ricans are Latinos, and their number should be counted with Latinos. And a follow-up question I'd like to pose to Dr. Fenton, and I appreciate all the work that you do. Back in April, a few months ago, we had a national discussion on HIV/AIDS. And the Latino community leaders, with many of the folks from CDC, created an agenda and asked for a response to a lot of the suggestions and advice that was made on a national level. And I wanted to know, where are we at with that, Dr. Fenton?
Thank you very much for that question. And first of all, let me acknowledge the work that has been done in the community to develop this national agenda and strategy. I have reviewed the strategy and the agenda, and it's a formidable work. It's very clear in what needs to be done. It's very specific in what you're trying to achieve, and I applaud the community on the work. I know that colleagues within our agency are looking at the document. We're looking at ways in which we can support, dovetail, and to enhance some of the work that you want to achieve in the strategy. Many of the things that you have called for, we are already working within the agency, and we are hoping to make that explicit to you. But there are also areas that you have highlighted to us that we need to enhance or to work with other agencies to meet those needs. So just to say that we are committed to looking at this, reviewing it, and to responding in a timely way. Thank you.
Hi, Matt Epperson from New York. I know we can't cover everything in just an hour, but I do think that one issue that didn't come up once that I think is very important is the criminal justice system and that it's basically absent in many ways in terms of HIV prevention, medical care, testing availability, continuity of care. The prevalence is higher in the criminal justice system for pretty much every demographic grouping. You know, it goes on and on. So I guess my question is, for any of you within your sort of sphere of influence, what are you doing to really integrate with the criminal justice system, and not just in terms of public safety, but really integrating with the criminal justice system to make it a public health issue?
Congresswoman?
Let me just quickly respond. This is an issue that, of course, has been swept under the rug. And just on the congressional front, there are several efforts taking place that are uphill battles, of course. First of all, we're very pleased that Congresswoman Maxine Waters was able to get her bill off of the floor requiring testing and counseling in prisons, in federal prisons. Secondly, it was mentioned the Justice Act, which would require the distribution of condoms in federal prisons, as well as the development of an overall plan to reduce sexually transmitted infections, HIV and AIDS, and what have you. Again, at the federal level, we've got to build political support for these issues, because we recognize the fact that that there's denial taking place, that many inmates, formerly incarcerated individuals, are coming out, and it really is an issue that has to be dealt with in a public health context and a social justice context. And so we have to look at how we develop the political will in our country to address this.
We only have time for two more questions. We have a panel waiting for us, so we'll take one from here and one from there.
Hi, I'm Abby Marr from Advocates for Youth in D.C. My question is actually for Dr. Khan. As a young person who graduated high school in 2005, I know how I would explain the leveling off in the past 7 to 8 years, but I was just wondering how you would explain the leveling off in a lot of data in the past 7 to 8 years, and how you propose the U.S. government works to delay onset of sexual debut and increase condom use in young people.
Thank you for your question.
Speak up.
Is it on? Okay. It's on. Okay. Thank you for your question. Unfortunately, with YRBS data, we can't answer that question because the YRBS only tells us what kids are doing, not why. But we do know from other research that sexual behaviors, like all behaviors, reflect a wide variety of factors. And it's hard to either credit or blame any one particular intervention or any one particular strategy for either our successes or our failures more recently. We obviously need interventions with proven evidence of effectiveness that not only will help kids delay the onset of intercourse, but also to use condoms once they do become sexually active. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Kenyon Farrell. I'm with Queers for Economic Justice in New York City, also here with AIDS2008.com, blogging with CHAMP. And my question is, listening to the research in the panel and having been a part of other conversations with scientists at the CDC and at other levels, we know that in the African-American community, and speaking particularly as a black gay man, that what's happening in our community is not about higher rates of unprotected sex or higher rates of drug use or higher rates of multiple sex partners when compared to white MSM, for example. But what I see missing, and what is always a footnote, is these structural issues like poverty, like homelessness, like prisons, which not only just about what's happening inside of prisons, but massive imprisonment in and of itself creating instability in terms of people's social and sexual networks and communities that are driving the epidemic in and of itself. So at what point are we going to stop making footnotes of the things that are driving the epidemic among people of African descent in the U.S. an actual priority in terms of the actual research and the policy priorities and the work being done at the federal, state, and local level?
Yeah. Well, let me just respond and say you are absolutely correct. I mean, this is an issue that goes right to the heart of our economic and social system in America. And until we recognize the fact that we have to get very involved, again, I have to say, in politics and demand reordering some of our budget priorities so that we can eliminate poverty or reduce poverty, universal health care, housing, this foreclosure crisis is wreaking havoc on low-income people, the poor, middle-income. And so we have to really have a discussion about what we want to see on the political agenda in terms of the Congress, the House, the Senate, and the President. Because until we do that, this will be piecemeal together, and we will never be able to deal with some of the systemic causes of the disparities that we're seeing in communities of color.
I just want to support what you've said. There are two individual level factors which I think are also, in addition to the structural factors, which may be explaining some of the disparities we're seeing among black gay men. The first is the high background prevalence of disease. So for any act of intercourse, black gay men are going to be at a much higher risk of acquiring HIV than other gay men. And we also know that some data suggests that the higher rates of STDs, which we see in the African-American community, are also present among black gay men, and that may also be facilitating disease transmission. But I'm not saying this to take away from your point, which is around how do we have a national discourse on structural interventions, on the social determinants of health. Certainly at CDC, we are beginning to do that work within the National Center, which I run. We are looking at more effective ways of tackling health disparities by adopting a social determinants framework, a framework that really encourages us to move upstream, to think not only of the individual factors, but to look at sexual networks within the community, to look at the healthcare infrastructures within the community, and to also look at what unique role CDC should be playing to address poverty, the high rates of incarceration, access to education, and access to health services. There are roles that we must play as a public health agency, but we cannot do it alone. But we're having this conversation now within our center, and you will be seeing more guidelines and more papers coming from us at CDC about this issue. So thank you for raising that.
Walt Senefit from CHAMP in Los Angeles, USA. I want to, Dr. Fitton and Dr. Valisari and numerous other speakers at this conference have highlighted the continuing, profound, pervasive homophobia, stigma, and discrimination against people of sexual diversity as a significant driver of the epidemic in the U.S., confirmed by the new figures that an absolute majority of incident infections are occurring in men who have sex with men. But yet, there's a profound lack of a national, active, multifaceted campaign explicitly against homophobia coming from and funded by the government, but also joined with in partnership with all levels of civil society. What I want to ask you, Dr. Fitton and Congresswoman Lee, is are there currently in place laws or governmental policies that would prohibit undertaking active campaigns and in all forms of intervention and modalities that we have available to us against homophobia and discrimination? And if so, what are they so that we can work to change them? And if not, what are you waiting for?
And this will be our last question.
Well, just on the congressional front, I have to say that this is an uphill battle. We did pass ENDA out of the House, non-discrimination, a bill, but left out was transgendered bisexual individuals, which was wrong. We have to fix that. Secondly, oftentimes when I talk about the MSM community, at the end of a hearing, members come up and folks ask me, what are you talking about? And I have to remember, I have to educate members of Congress also. So this is something that I think is going to require massive grassroots mobilizing around, because until we hear from everyone in our country on Capitol Hill, I don't think we're going to be able to address homophobia the way we should in a very real way. So we all have to work together to raise the level of awareness with regard to, you know, the United States government on the serious discrimination that takes place in our country.
Please remember what you learned this week about the epidemic in the United States when you exercise your right to vote in less than 3 months.
Can I just say one thing? We were able to lift the travel ban, finally, and that took an act of Congress, but we're trying to get the regulations implemented now. So that's one small step in the direction that we need to go so that, you know, we will hopefully one day have an international AIDS conference in America.
Thank you, Congresswoman Lee, and our distinguished panel. Thank you, everybody.
Congresswoman Lee, nice to see you again. Keep up the good work.